In January, it came time to move into the governor's mansion and get ready for the inauguration. The hardest thing about the transition was getting used to the security. I'd always prided myself on my self-sufficiency and prized my private time. I had been self-supporting since I was 20 and, over the years, had gotten used to cleaning house, running errands, and cooking. When Hillary and I got together, we shared the household duties. Now other people cooked the meals, cleaned the house, and ran the errands. Since I was 16, I had enjoyed driving alone in my own car, listening to music and thinking. I couldn't do that anymore. I liked to jog every day, usually before or after work. Now I was being followed by a trooper in an unmarked car. It really bothered me at first. It made me want to run up one-way streets the wrong way. But in time I got used to it and came to appreciate the work the folks at the mansion and the troopers did. They gave me more time for the job. Because the troopers drove me, I got a lot of paperwork done in transit. Eventually, we agreed that I'd drive myself to church on Sundays. It wasn't much of a concession, since my church and the Methodist church Hillary attended were both within a mile of the mansion, but I really looked forward to my Sunday freedom ride. One of the troopers ran with me when he was on duty, and I liked that a lot better than being followed. After I'd been in office several years and there was clearly no imminent threat, I often ran alone in the mornings, but along a predictable downtown route with lots of people around. Frequently, I ended those runs at the McDonald's or the local bakery, both about a half mile from the mansion, where I'd get a cup of water, then a cup of coffee, then walk back home. The day after the inauguration, I went to work for what would prove to be two of the most exhilarating and exhausting, rewarding and frustrating years of my life. I was always in a hurry to get things done, and this time my reach often exceeded my grasp. As 1980 dawned, after a year of hard work, I felt good about the governorship and my life. I had made some powerful interests angry, but I had a long list of progressive accomplishments in education, healthcare, and the environment, of which I was very proud. Hillary and I badly wanted to have a child and had been trying for some time without success. In the summer of 1979, we decided to make an appointment with a fertility expert in San Francisco as soon as we got back from a short vacation in Bermuda. We had a wonderful time. So wonderful, we never made it to San Francisco. Soon after we got home, Hillary found out she was pregnant. She kept working at the Rose Law Firm for several months, and we attended Lamaze classes in anticipation of my participating in a natural childbirth. I really enjoyed those classes and the time we spent with the other expectant parents, who were mostly middle-class working people, just as excited as we were. A few weeks before her delivery date, Hillary was having a few problems. Her doctor told her she absolutely couldn't travel. We had complete confidence in him and understood that she had to observe his travel ban. Unfortunately, that meant she couldn't go with me to the annual Washington meeting of the National Governors Association, including dinner at the White House. I went on to the conference, took Carolyn Huber, who'd left the Rose Law Firm to run the governor's mansion for us, to the White House dinner, called home every few hours, and returned as soon as I could on the night of February 27th. 15 minutes after I walked into the governor's mansion, Hillary's water broke, 3 weeks early. I was nervous as a cat, carrying around my list of Lamaze materials to take to Arkansas Baptist Hospital. The state troopers who worked at the mansion were nervous, too. I asked them to get the bag of ice cubes for Hillary to suck on while I gathered the other stuff. They did, a 9-pound bag, enough to last her through a week of labor. With the trunk loaded with Hillary's ice, the troopers got us to the hospital in no time. Soon after we arrived, we learned Hillary would have to give birth by cesarean section because the baby was in breech, upside down in the womb. I was told that hospital policy did not permit fathers in the delivery room when an operation was necessary. I pleaded with the hospital administrator to let me go in, saying that I had been to surgeries with mother and that they could cut Hillary open from head to toe and I wouldn't get sick or faint. Whereas Hillary was on edge because she had never been a hospital patient in her entire life. She needed me there. They relented. At 11:24 p.m., I held Hillary's hand and looked over the screen blocking her view of the cutting and bleeding to see the doctor lift our baby out of her body. It was the happiest moment of my life, one my own father never knew. Our little girl was a healthy 6 pounds, 1¾ ounces. And she cried on cue. While Hillary was in the recovery room, I carried Chelsea out to mother and anyone else who was available to see the world's most wonderful baby. I talked to her and sang to her. I never wanted that night to end. At last I was a father. Despite my love for politics and government and my growing ambitions, I knew then that being a father was the most important job I'd ever have. Thanks to Hillary and Chelsea, it also turned out to be the most rewarding. In August of 1980, Hillary and I went to Denver for the summer meeting of the National Governors Association. All the talk was of presidential politics. President Carter seemed to have survived a vigorous challenge to his renomination from Senator Edward Kennedy, but Kennedy had not withdrawn. Bob Strauss, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, asked me to get the Democratic Governors Association to endorse President Carter over Senator Kennedy. After a quick canvass of the governors present, I told Strauss the vote would be 20-4 for Carter. We had a civilized debate with Strauss speaking for the president and Governor Hugh Carey of New York arguing for Kennedy. After the 20-4 vote, Strauss and I spoke briefly to the press, touting the endorsement as a show of confidence in and a political boost for President Carter at a time when he needed it. I returned home from Denver to a very volatile political situation. My opponent in the general election, Frank White, was gaining ground. White was a big man with a booming voice and a bombastic style that belied his background as a graduate of the Naval Academy, savings and loan executive, and former director of the Arkansas Industrial Development Commission under Governor Pryor. He had strong backing from all the interest groups I'd taken on, including utility, poultry, trucking, and timber companies, and the medical associations. He was a born-again Christian with the strong support of the state chapter of the Moral Majority and other conservative activists. And he had the pulse of the country people and blue-collar workers upset about an unpopular hike in car license fees and the thousands of Cuban refugees President Carter had sent to Arkansas. They had rioted in June. White also had the advantage of a generally disgruntled mood due to a bad economy and the worst drought in 50 years. When the down economy led to a decline in state revenues below projections, I was forced to lower state spending to balance the budget. On Election Day, November 4th, Jimmy Carter and I were both defeated in Arkansas, getting 48% of the vote, down from his 65% in 1976 and my 63% in 1978. After a fitful night's sleep, Hillary, Chelsea, and I met with a couple of hundred of our diehard supporters on the back lawn of the governor's mansion. I gave them the best speech I could, thanking them for all they'd done, telling them to be proud of all we'd accomplished, and offering my cooperation to Frank White. It was a pretty upbeat talk, considering the circumstances. Inside, I was filled with regret that I would no longer be able to do the work I love so much. After leaving the governor's mansion, I went to work for Wright, Lindsay, and Jennings, a large firm by Arkansas standards, with a fine reputation and a varied practice. I did some legal work and brought in a couple of modest clients, but I'm sure the lifeline the firm threw me didn't make it any money. All the firm really got was my everlasting gratitude and some legal business defending me when I was president. Though I missed being governor and the excitement of politics, I enjoyed the more normal pace of my life, coming home at a reasonable hour, being with Hillary as we watched Chelsea grow into her life, going out to dinner with friends and getting to know our neighbors. By the spring of 1981, Frank White was beginning to make mistakes. The governor looked vulnerable in the next election, and I began to think of a rematch. One day, I drove from Little Rock to Hot Springs to see Mother. About halfway there, I pulled into the parking lot of the gas station and store at Lonsdale. The man who owned it was active in local politics, and I wanted to see what he thought about my chances. He was friendly, but noncommittal. As I walked back to my car, I ran into an elderly man in overalls. He said, "Aren't you Bill Clinton?" When I said I was and shook his hand, he couldn't wait to tell me that he had voted against me. "I'm one of those who helped beat you. I cost you 11 votes. Me, my wife, my two boys and their wives, and five of my friends. We just leveled you." I asked him why and got the predictable reply. "I had to. You raised my car tags." I pointed to a spot on the highway not far from where we were standing and said, "Remember that ice storm we had when I took office? That piece of road over there buckled and cars were stuck in the ditch. I had to get the National Guard to pull them out. There were pictures of it in all the papers. Those roads had to be fixed." He replied, "I don't care. I still didn't want to pay it." For some reason, after all he'd said, I blurted out, "Let me ask you something. If I ran for governor again, would you consider voting for me?" He smiled and said, "Sure I would. We're even now." I went right to the payphone, called Hillary, told her the story, and said I thought we could win. On February 2, 1980, Chelsea's second birthday, I asked the voters to give me a second chance. After tough primary and runoff elections, I won the Democratic nomination. Then, on November 2nd, I became the first Arkansas governor ever to be elected, defeated, and elected again, winning 55% of the vote and carrying 56 of the 75 counties. I swept the 11 counties in northeast Arkansas, which I had lost in 1980, and where we had worked especially hard. And the black vote was staggering. Fueled by support for me, in opposition to Frank White's conservative record and harsh rhetoric.